Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week of science. I'm here with Lyndon. Hello, Lyndon.
Hello, Claire. Lovely to be with you on this yet another journey into the science sphere.
Yet another journey into the science sphere. I'm so pumped because early this year, actually, it was in the first episode of 2026 for us all. I was talking about how I wanted to get a bit of an understanding about why there were so many shark encounters or shark attacks happening. Yes. And this week, I had the pleasure of talking to Professor Shakoufe Shamsi from Charles Sturt University. Shakoufe is a veterinary parasitologist. And she had some really interesting insights into just animal behavior and just some of the aspects of shark encounters or shark attacks that I wouldn't have thought about, including sort of like things that affect shark behavior that affect other animals' behavior, but why aren't we taking them into account when we're thinking about sharks, like parasites and pollutants from the environment, things that affect animals every day in very physiological, biological ways that aren't really talked about.
When you said you were going to talk to an expert to learn a bit more about the increase in shark encounters over the summer, I did not expect you to be talking to a parasitologist. You know, I thought you might be speaking to someone who knows about ocean currents or ocean pollution or shark behaviour.
I can't wait to
listen to the chat, Claire. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And Shakoufe has written an excellent conversation piece about this as well. So that is a great accompaniment to this episode of Lost in Science. Anyway, Lyndon, how about you?
Well, I'm also making good on some promises that I made at the start of the year. This one was an internal promise to myself, because when I saw this piece that I wanted to explore today on the show, when I saw it come out a couple of months ago, I thought, oh my God, we have to cover that. So even though the science is a couple of months old, I still think it's worth bringing to the studio today, because the study has really cemented some understanding about human migration in our part of the world. And this was a paper that came out in Nature late January that has dated the oldest rock art in the world.
Wow.
It has preceded the age of previous rock art by about 1,000 years. So we're going to talk about that. Talk about what this means for the story of Australians and how amazing it is to have this rock art actually so close to us, so close to home. So you'll have to rein me in a bit, because I'm really excited about this story as well. So,
oh, it is definitely something worth celebrating. I mean, humans love talking about themselves. Oh, brilliant. On with the show. So in January this year, there were 4 shark attacks that happened in New South Wales in just 48 hours, putting beachgoers on high alert and sparking renewed debate about why these encounters and attacks happen. But beyond the sharks themselves, scientists are starting to look at how other factors influence shark behaviour. Pollution, stormwater runoff, or even parasites moving from the land into the ocean, affecting animal health and behaviour.
So to help us unpack this bigger ecological picture, this week we are joined by Shakoufeh Shamsi, who is a professor in veterinary parasitology from Charles Sturt University. Shakoufeh, welcome to Lost in Science.
Hi, thank you very much for having me in your program.
So let's start with the shark attacks in January. Now, when events like this happen, obviously they are incredibly tragic, but the focus often falls on the sharks. From your understanding and from a marine health perspective, what are the other factors that should be taken into account here?
Yeah, let me start by saying that when you directly get affected by shark attacks or someone you know, it is a really huge emotional impact, understandably. It's just horrible. I can't even imagine. And I really express my sympathy to people who are affected directly or indirectly. However, it's really important to remember a few things. First of all, sharks do not attack humans because we are not there. Prey, or they don't eat us really, like seals and other animals in the oceans. These are the ones that they usually feed from. So it's really important to maybe even not to use the word shark attack. The right term is shark encounters. And also understand the behavior. Behavior study is a really fascinating area of science, whether it's humans or it's animals. And again, when it comes to a lot of areas of research, when scientists do research, because they are also humans, they usually look at things that are easily visible and sensible, and then they look at that to study those ones. So when it comes to behavior, everyone look at the stress. For example, a stress by polluted air, because the air gets smoky, you can feel it and you can see it, smell it. But there are always other things in our environment that we do not see, but they are big players. One good example is microbiome. There are plenty of research emerging that how microbiome can impact behavior, can impact health and everything else in humans. And the question is, why not having the same impacts on animals? And now when it comes to parasites, they are really interesting organisms in our planet. More than 50% of the Earth's biodiversity are parasitic species, right? However, they are not easily visible most of the time because they are either inside another host, like even if they are big, they are inside, so we cannot see them, or a lot of time they are really small and microscopic. So for that reason, they are usually get overlooked. And the impacts goes beyond and goes to how much research and things we do. Anyway, going back to our sharks. Sharks live in the ocean, obviously. There are so many different species of them. And they are top predator. That means that they, like in the food chain, we have a smaller animals, bigger animals eat a smaller, and then it just goes like that. So they are the large animal right at the top, which means they are quite precious. We don't have many of these. And when animal becomes so big, so large, and has that position in a food chain, usually their populations these days, these animals are endangered. They are precious in our ecosystem. They have really important role to manage the population and the whole ecosystem as we see. So just being afraid of them, and then any behavior or some behaviors they express, interpreted as attack, and then inevitably get defensive about it and emotional about it and have things like let's get rid of all of them in the oceans is not really good. It doesn't have the wisdom required to manage our environments and our oceans. Anyway, sharks, like any other animals, they can have their own parasites. So the involvement of myself and my research team with shark and the conversation article that you're referring to, all started with that I had an amazing colleague, Dr. Di Barton, in my lab a few years ago, and she had these samples of parasites, and she said they are from hammerhead shark. And then when we were doing that and looking at those samples, we realized that not many research have been done on these sharks. Then it came about 2023 in Port Lincoln. There was this conference called Great White Shark Global. The blurb about the conference was saying that it happens once every 10 years. And I thought, I have to go there because, like, I know this little tiny bit about sharks' parasites, and I'd like to know great white shark, what do they have? How much to know about their health and diseases? And I went there. There were these amazing scientists from all countries around the world presenting really, really good research. But I was stunned because I was the only one who was talking about parasites. There was nothing about health and disease. It was about, like all topics discussed are very, very important, obviously, like behavior and everything, but nothing about, like, people were talking about behavior they saw in a shark. Like by tagging them, going from one place to another, or exhibiting this sort of behavior with mating or this and that. But no one even considered that if you have a parasite, all these things could get hijacked and be differently because that's what we know. And I'll give you some examples. Parasites are organisms that feed from us. So if someone feeds from you, what happens? You lose your energy. You lose the food that was supposed to give you energy. You're sharing that with someone else. So the first thing is you become fatigued. It could be as simple as just losing your energy, or could be bigger than that and doing other things. So when those things happen, clearly someone is tired. So it's really legitimate to think that the same thing happens to animals. Like in veterinary science, we do a lot of research on livestock. So we know that livestock that have parasites could get stressed and things. But we don't extend that to other important animals like sharks in our oceans. So that article, part of that article is about this, that we need to do research on sharks, parasites, to understand the impact. And now parasites do another things. Sometimes they get stuck in their host, like could be human or could be something else. And when they get stuck there, they don't like it. They want to just, like many other pathogenic organisms, they like to just get distribute. And basically what the term we use is infect or contaminate all other animals or individuals in the ecosystems. But when they get inside some host, they get trapped there. And when they get trapped there, they have to find a way to get out. And usually they do it by changing the behavior of the infected animals. A very, very infamous parasite that many people know about it, even if they are not scientists, is the cat parasite or toxoplasma. A lot of research has been done on that. Anyone Googles it finds a lot of information. And what it does is it goes through body, different parts of the body, especially into the brain, and makes behavioral changes. For example, this one might be interesting for your audience, that like in women usually makes them flirty, but in men it makes them aggressive and gets them into the fight. Overall, what it does also in animals and humans is, if we summarized all different types of change, behavioral change, is it increases risky behavior. Now, I am based in Wagga Wagga, and it's far away from the ocean. And I'm very fortunate about it because I believe it gives me perspective to look at research by other people in different way. Because all those marine, fantastic, amazing, highly knowledgeable marine biologists spend all their lives in the ocean. So they don't get the land perspective. There are plenty of cats here. They are not in the ocean. They're here. And I know based on research in my team and other scientists that many cats in Australia, as high as 40% of cats are infected with this parasite. So as they walk around, they just shed it around, right? And I also, like in Wagga Wagga, which is in the Riverina region, we are often affected by floods. And I know all these flood waters just get run off to the oceans. And then I read in the news that shark attacks usually are higher when the flood happens and there is wash off of the rain into the water. So all these get connected for me. Cat parasites that is known and infamous for behavioral change, and it increases risky behavior, aggressive behavior, and stuff like that. And it gets washed off to the ocean and increase shark attacks immediately after rain. I'm not saying that all shark encounters are because of this parasite or this, but it definitely has a role and is something that needs to be aware of and do research and provide evidence. So the whole point of that article and my research at this stage is to encourage scientists, they also think about parasites that they could have and factor that one in. When they do the sampling, it's really difficult. It's really hard to be a marine biologist to work on shark biology and ecology. So when they manage to do that and put all those efforts and do the sampling, it's really, really important to also consider get the most data out of those samples and specimens. And some of it could be looking at parasites, for example, Toxoplasma. I just used it as example because it's the most easily understood parasite, but there are plenty more out there that no one does research about. So if you want to understand sharks, it's really important we understand they can get sick like us, they can get angry like us, they can get stressed like us. If you want to understand all of this, we need to understand what parasites they have as well.
And I imagine it's not just parasites that are coming from the land into the ocean, but also how parasites manifest themselves in the ocean environment as well.
When I went to that conference about great white shark, I talked to Dr. Dai Barton, which I mentioned right at the beginning, and I said, Dai, we need to do a research to see what parasites great white shark has. And it's obviously so difficult to get samples and stuff like that. And we did a review article and we found that very, very limited parasites have been reported. And there is really, really huge knowledge gap there that this needs to be done. But like another thing that potentially get washed off and goes to the ocean, along with all these floods and stuff, is pesticides. And again, that's not directly my area of research, but as a scientist, I always have, an inquisitive mind. And we know that these pesticides in humans cause a lot of neurological diseases, have been shown to have connections with presence of pesticides in our food. And that's why we have all those basically legislations to manage use of pesticides in agricultural products because we know that it causes all those neurological damages. So why it shouldn't have that same impact on our marine animals, including our sharks? And that's another thing that needs to be tested, which I don't think ever been tested in Australia.
Well, Shakufe, it's been wonderful to talk to you and get your fascinating insights into some of the other factors and some of the other environmental concerns and I guess under-researched areas that contribute to some of these shark encounters or shark attacks that have happened over January. So thank you so much for your viewpoint and adding to this conversation. And I really am looking forward to hearing more about your research and how it continues to develop.
Welcome back. You are listening to Lost in Science, and let's imagine for a second that you're not where you are. You are in a boat off the coast of Indonesia. You're on off the southwest coast of Sulawesi. Claire, have you been to Sulawesi?
I haven't been to Sulawesi. No, I've been to some of the islands around there. Flores, where the hobbit Homo floresiensis was discovered, but I haven't been to Sulawesi.
Well, if you go off the southwest coast of Sulawesi, there is a various islands there. There's one island called Muna Island, and in Muna Island, you will find a collection of caves. There's one cave, there's quite a few caves there actually, that are popular tourist destinations. They're tourist destinations because they have a lot of rock art in them. The rock art that you can see most clearly, generally considered to be about 4,000 years old. There's a lot of rock art dotted around that area, and there's a lot of research that's been done over the last few decades exploring the history of hominoids there. Homo sapiens, the last step in the evolutionary chain that got to us. Well, that is us, right? We're the end point so far. And the rock art that we find in that region tells an amazing tale. There are some really fascinating styles of rock art in that region. There is a unique type of handprint style that you can find only in the Sulawesi area, where a person will blow ochre onto their hand and then remove their hand and then move their hand slightly and do it again. So what you're left with is kind of claw marks or claw prints.
Oh. But it's the same person's hand?
Oh, I think it's the same person's hand.
Yeah, okay.
Cannot confirm that, but I suppose it would need to be a similar size to kind of get that overlap. So you ended up with this kind of long claw pointed shapes.
Oh, cool.
Very interesting. Quite a unique style for that part of the world. And it was this kind of pattern that was identified and dated and published recently in Nature that researchers have identified as the oldest rock art in the world.
How old, Lyndon?
How old?
Surely it's more than a couple of thousand years old.
Definitely more than a couple of thousand years old. Okay, so the previous record keeper was dated in about 2018, comes from Spain, and I think that was about 66,000 years old.
Okay, we're getting up there.
Exactly. We're talking the Pleistocene era, like it's a different geological era. And those pieces of rock art in Spain, in Europe, these are the oldest ones there, have been attributed to Neanderthals.
Yeah. Oh.
So there's a little controversy about the exact dating of those pieces of rock art, but...
Are they found alongside bones, Neanderthal bones?
I'm not quite sure about that. And that's also a question that is ongoing with these particular pieces that were found in Sulawesi, because there isn't a lot of evidence of the types of hominids that made these pieces of rock art. But the Spanish rock art have been attributed to Neanderthals, I'm guessing because there was other associated evidence around the area that it drew a straight line that it was that kind of species that was living in the area at that time. There isn't a lot of evidence in Sulawesi, but the authors of this paper that came out, I've got to give a shout out to the authorship team, 40 authors from 22 different organizations.
Wow.
Australia and Indonesia. So it's Southern Cross University, Griffith University, and a lot of museums and archaeological organizations and research institutes in Indonesia as well. Like, thank goodness this isn't a colonial discovery of something. You know, this is people working together across the two countries using the kit in Australia and working together to find these pieces of art and explore them. Anyway, so, yeah, there's two handprints, partial handprints in this cave on this island off the southwest coast of Sulawesi. They have been able to date not the rock art itself, because it's very hard to date actual rock art, but they've dated the calcium on top, right? It's called coralloid speleothems or cave popcorn, little bits.
Popcorn, love it.
Cave popcorn, how good's that?
Little
bits of buildup, mineral buildup that's happened over time. So they've dated this very precisely. It looks as though the authors have thought of any possible additional contamination that could have occurred that might affect the date. There's a lot of uncertainty. So the lowest, like the youngest age, that's the age that they're advertising. This is the youngest possible date it could be. So it could be a lot older. 67,800 years.
Wow.
Of the two handprints that they found, that's the youngest date of the oldest one, if that makes sense. Yeah. So this finding has a lot to tell us about the richness of the culture of the hominids that were living there. As I said, the authors are speculating that it's Homo sapiens because of the creativity shown in this style of kind of claw prints. But they can't say for sure. It also adds extra credence to the research that suggests that the first Australians arrived 65,000 years ago. If there's evidence that there were people in the Sulawesi kind of Sunda area, which is sort of that region, if there were people there that time, then that makes it another line of evidence to suggest that humans could have very easily gotten to Australia 65,000 years ago.
So is this sort of around the same time that there was a land bridge? There was a lot of water that was locked up in ice. The sea level was lower.
So I don't think there was a land bridge between modern-day Indonesia and modern-day Australia, but what we did have was two larger continents, Sunda, which is sort of the Asian area, and Sahul, which is where Papua New Guinea and Australia were connected.
Right, okay.
So there are a couple of theories about how humans migrated across Sunda to Sahul, whether they went a northern route or a southern route. And then it was a water crossing. It's hypothesized that it's a water crossing that got people from Asia into Sahul. The research was funded by National Geographic, so there's excellent visuals that are associated with it. The Australian government funded some of it. I think Google funded some of it. It's great to see lots of organizations working together to help progress our understanding of our history, of our deep history, and to have it so close to Australia. It's cool.
It's so amazing. And what just continues to blow my mind is really there's everything that it tells us about humans, but then there's also the conservation of it all. How do you conserve a painting for 67,000 years? Yes. What incredible technology, you know, that they have developed to be able to make that handprint last for that long in that
conditions. And how lucky we are. I mean, I'm not sure whether you'd be able to say that the people who made the artwork knew that the art would stick around for that long. Who knows how many stencils and how many pieces have been lost over 67 plus thousand years. But the researchers of this study are keen to say how lucky and how fortunate they were that these little cave popcorns formed when they did. So the minerals and the chemicals required to do the analysis happened to be there so they could date the layering on top of the cave, the rock art, because there's lots of rock art that's very, very difficult to date. So I feel like their argument is that they've got really lucky there, and the next step is to explore other caves in the region to try to find evidence of what species made this rock art, and that can really open the door to figure out how the door got open for the first Australians to arrive here.
And that's all we have time for on another episode of Lost in Science. Thanks for listening. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the Ngunnawal people and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at lostinsci@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook where we are Lost in Science on 3CR. Or you can just tune in wherever you find us, on your radio, on your podcast, next week when Chris, Stu, Lyndon and Claire get Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.